This is Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres. Thanks for joining us this hour on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. This week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Rosemary Sullivan about her book, The Betrayal of Anne Frank. It's a book that's become mired in controversy since our interview was recorded on March 3rd. Ever since the original publication of Anne Frank's diary by her father, Otto Frank, in 1952, the identity of the betrayer of the Franks' hiding place to the German authorities has been the burning question about that history. Rosemary Sullivan's book, The Betrayal of Anne Frank, was published in mid-January. We've interviewed Sullivan before about her award-winning biography of Stalin's daughter. The Betrayal of Anne Frank takes the reader through a cold case investigation, the subtitle of the book, undertaken by an investigative team that included retired FBI agent Vincent Pankoch. After examining and rejecting several other figures who've been suspected of the betrayal, the team concluded that the betrayer was a Jewish notary named Arnold Vandenberg, who died in 1960. But soon after the book's publication, several eminent Dutch historians went public with doubts about its conclusions. And just last week, the publisher of the Dutch edition of the book, Ambos Athos, withdrew it from bookstores and announced that all copies of the book in its possession would be pulped. The American publisher, HarperCollins, has stood by the book. In a statement released to me by HarperCollins, the author Rosemary Sullivan wrote, "Although I was not involved in the research process, I have full confidence in the investigation led by Vince Pankoch into the betrayal of Anne Frank. Certain critics have questioned the book's conclusion that a Jewish notary, Arnold Vandenberg, gave a list of anonymous addresses to the SD, which included that of the secret annex where Anne Frank and her family were hiding. This conclusion was reached in part because of the lengths to which Otto Frank and Miep Hies went to protect the identity of the betrayer. It is the critics who refer to Vandenberg as a traitor. The team is always careful to see him as a victim whose motive was to save his family from deportation and death under the Nazi occupation." Now, that is part of the statement by Rosemary Sullivan that was sent to me by HarperCollins. I've posted the full statement on the Writer's Voice website, writersvoice.net, as well as links to both sides of the controversy, including the critique of the book's conclusions and a rebuttal from Vincent Pankoch. I'm not a historian. However, I do know a fair amount about the history of the Netherlands under German occupation because, as longtime listeners of this show know, I've been working on a book that, in part, explores my father's involvement with an underground group in Amsterdam that sheltered Jews during that time. My father, Guido Tennyson, hid a Jewish teenager in his apartment for nearly 3 years and found hiding places for others. He was also a courier for the resistance against the Nazis, working with his brother. I have, in fact, just finished that book and am working on its publication. So I was very interested in interviewing Rosemary Sullivan about the betrayal of Anne Frank. As you hear in our interview, we discuss at length the larger implications for our time of the persecution of the Jews in the Netherlands during World War II, the devastating consequences of hatred and bigotry, the forces that push people to collaborate with oppression, whether under duress or conviction, and the utter failure of violence to do anything but threaten the well-being of all. I won't weigh in on the merits of the controversy itself, but leave it to interested listeners to read the book and explore the critique of its conclusions and Pankoch's rebuttal. And now to our interview with author Rosemary Sullivan. Rosemary Sullivan, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
The Betrayal of Anne Frank, a cold case investigation. This was the third, I believe, investigation into who may have betrayed Anne Frank. Is that correct? There were two previous ones?
Two official ones, yes. There was a 1948 investigation by the post-war investigation led by a man called Niebuhr. It was rather perfunctory. I think the at that point the police were understaffed because so many, or a percentage anyway, had been collaborators. Then there was one in 1963, which was much more sophisticated, led by a man called Detective Van Helden, and then now this cold case investigation, which follows some of the strategies of a police investigation. But of course, there have been many books which have speculated about who might have betrayed the Anne Frank and her family and the others in hiding. You know, we thought a lot about the title of the book, and there had been several articles called The Betrayal of Anne Frank, and then there's the Anne Frank House and the Anne Frank Stitching and the Anne Frank Foundation. So we thought, you know, it's the betrayal of the whole eight people plus two of the helpers on that day of August 4th, 1944. But Anne Frank has always become the symbol that collects that story.
And so after all this time, more than 70 years, why was this taken up again? What was the point of this investigation? What did the investigators hope to find? Beyond even if finding the identity of the betrayer?
The person who initiated the project was a filmmaker, Dutch filmmaker called Thijs Beyen. And Thijs, when I talked to him about his motives, he said, well, one of the things we were having dinner and talking about the shift towards ideological divisiveness in Europe. The anti-immigrant sentiment, we call it the right. I don't know if right and left are the right words anymore, but a kind of hardening of attitudes. And he said he was walking through the city and he was seeing the people lined up in front of Anne Frank, in front of the Anne Frank house. And he said, you know, that story, which is a warning against ideological divisiveness, should be retold. He discovered in the process of his search that his grandparents had an inkling of this, but it was clarified that his grandparents had actually hidden Jews during the Second World War. And he was able to meet a man who had stayed with the family most of the time, describing the radio that was buried in the basement and the closet where he hid. And so Thijs decided, I'm going to go for this. He turned to his friend, Peter van Twisk. And for Peter, the Anne Frank story is in many ways a Dutch story. He felt that perhaps half the population, only half the population, had coped and dealt with the fact and faced the fact that something like 72% of Dutch Jews were deported to the camps. Of the 107,000 people deported, 5,500 returned. And this was the worst record of any Western European country. And he felt that could be explored through this issue. And he also, in his search of archives, discovered that his grandfather, who carried his name, Peter van Twisk, or he carried his grandfather's name, to be more accurate, had also worked for the resistance and hidden Jews and had been responsible for collecting arms and according to the resistance account, had taken great, great risks. So that began it. They decided they needed somebody who was an outsider because there were so many complexities to the response to the whole issue of Anne Frank in Holland. And so they turned to associates in the Dutch police department who recommended Vince Panko, the FBI, retired FBI cold case investigator who had worked on everything from Colombian drug raids to corruption on Wall Street. And Vince said yes. So for Vince, he said it was also personal. Everybody had a personal attachment to the story. His father had fought in the Second World War and had been one of the American soldiers who had first entered one of the subsidiary camps to Dachau. And his father had always been scarred by that and told him about that. But more than that, he feels that he was shocked to discover that something like 2/3 of students in the United States, you know, grade school and so on, had no idea that 6 million people had been killed in the Holocaust. And he felt it was his responsibility, his generation's responsibility, to make this known. So I think the investigation was very high-minded. It was serious. There was a feeling that perhaps through the search for the betrayer of the Anne Frank family and the others in the annex, it would provide a model for other stories that have never been answered.
Now, what made this cold case team that think that they could actually solve this case now? What's changed, you know, let's say with modern technology that they used that enabled them to process, you know, what must be really millions of data points?
Well, that's exactly the point. Vince had already, of course, worked with AI technology, artificial intelligence in his investigations, and so understood that with internet and databases, it would be possible to draw connections. So in fact, they turned very early on in the investigation to a company called Exomia, a Dutch data company, who created a platform. And it meant that the team could upload onto the artificial intelligence platform all the information they could collect. They could cross-reference and find connections between people and addresses, policemen's on raids that weren't obvious before. Vince did was he turned to something which is extraordinary. It's called the Caber Files, the Central Archive of Extraordinary Justice in The Hague, which has 450,000 dossiers. It's 2.5 miles long. And it's the post-war investigations of criminals, of those acquitted, of victims, of witnesses. And, you know, I've often been asked that normally I do my own research. This is not a project that one person can research. There were at moments 23 people who were carrying on different research questions. And so the Caber files were put on the database, and eventually, under the direction of Monique Kohns, who took a leave of absence from the Dutch government job she had, in order to take on this case because she had such an attachment in her early journalism days to Anne Frank, she created what she called and what the group called the book case, which was such a moving title for the way in which they organized, according to the suspects, all the information that they'd gathered. So Vince was able to look at the NARA files in Maryland, millions of captured documents that American soldiers brought back in World War II. In the NARA files, he discovered 1,000 Kopfgelds. Now, Kopfgelds were bounty payments to the members of the IB4 unit or Jew hunting unit, mostly Dutch policemen who worked for the SD, the German intelligence, and discovered that, that these people were going out and looking for Jews in hiding and using V-Fraus and V-Man. It had been suspected, but this evidence that Vince found confirmed it. So it was a huge research undertaking. It took 5 years. And the assistance of young historians who worked full time in the office, others who volunteered, Vince and his team to come up with this.
Right. And we should say that was Kopfgeld, which head money, so money per head, and V, Frauen, the V for Trauen, which is like trusted women and trusted men. These are actually betrayers. Right. This is really fascinating, the degree to which this allowed them to go through an enormous amount of information. And I'm going to come back to this point later on, because ultimately it wasn't so much this that led to the final decision. But let's save this for a little bit and kind of lay some of the groundwork here.
You do bring up something important. The perversion of language that the Nazis exercise. So you call the Office of Jewish Immigration when in fact you mean deportation. You talk about V-Frauen when you mean, you use the word trust when in fact it's betrayal. It was a constant violation of language. And, you know, we'll also probably come to this subject later, the idea that we are seeing this perversion of language again.
Exactly. I think that's so important. You know, there's a whole book that was written by Victor Klemperer about the perversion of language that was practiced by the Nazis, and it's a direct line to Putin and Trump.
That's right.
So I want to go back, though, for a moment, because you write in this book, Rosemary Sullivan, in The Betrayal of Anne Frank, that the first shock to this cold case team was the degree of acrimony among the various stakeholders of the Anne Frank legacy, who actually did not help the investigation. So tell us about that, and what do you think their reasons behind that were?
In the beginning of the book, I introduced the cold case team. I start off with the green policeman, the raid and the green policeman, Silberbauer, because somehow for me that characterizes what this book is about. On the one hand, Otto Frank believing in rules with his incredible attention, and you see him still living the moment of that arrest, just, you know, months before he expected them to be liberated and free, suddenly the armed Nazis are at his door. And then Silberbauer, that man of such egocentric, terrifying disinterest in the responsibility he held for the death of these people. Then the next is to introduce the team, and then finally talk about the stakeholders, because the first thing that Theis and Peter did was they went to find out who they should be approaching. They turned to the Anne Frank house and the Anne Frank stitching and found wonderful cooperation. They were given access to the archives, to the files. They were able to interview people, given advice as to who to contact. And then they contacted the Anne Frank Fonds in Basel, in Switzerland. Both organizations had actually been founded by Otto Frank. The Anne Frank House had been under, the house itself had been about to be sold and under threat when at the kind of influence of Otto and the intrusion of others into it, it was saved and the Anne Frank Foundation was established. And when Otto Frank moved with his second wife, Fritzi, to Switzerland to join relatives there, he established the Anne Frank Fonds to control the copyright. However, he left the ownership, if you want, if that's the right word, the guardians of the diary itself was the Dutch government, because he knew they would always protect it. He said he had no idea what would happen to the various foundations or fonds. When Theis and Peter and Vince by this time approached the Fonds in Basel and asked if they could have permission to investigate their files, they flew to Basel, and they met the board, and it was reasonably civil. But when finally they said were asked what they were going to call the book, at that moment they were going to call it Anne Frank, a cold case diary. And the Fonz immediately said, we hold the copyright over that name. You cannot use it. It is our brand, which is, of course, impossible. You cannot brand a name. And then when over time I asked for permission to quote from Anne Frank's diary or from Otto Frank's letters, it was one delay after the other, until finally the rights person at Random House wrote to say, unfortunately, we didn't have permission to quote from those two sources. It seems that the Anne Frank Fonz is very protective of their control. They have, on several occasions, I have been told, sued the Anne Frank Foundation in Amsterdam, saying that they, Basel, own the copyright, and in fact have won these cases in court. So why would they be possessive about this? Who knows? I could come up with some ideas, but I'm not going to.
Now, the diary itself, I was moved to read in your book, The Betrayal of Anne Frank, a Cold Case Investigation, Rosemary Sullivan, when you said that it's a living document whose reception changes with what we know or are willing to confront. What did you mean by that?
Well, I've been reading Cynthia Ozziak and others. When the book was published in 1947, it was just a small publication, you know, sold 3,000 copies or whatever. But slowly, particularly after it was made into a film and into a play, it took on a particular cast. By the 50s, people wanted to leave the war behind. And so both of those vehicles, the film and the play, end with Anne saying, I don't know how after, this is a paraphrase, obviously, I don't know how after everything I've been through, I can still keep my ideals. By the 60s, when we were willing to look more seriously at what Nazism had been, then there was a quote from Anne Frank that I felt was much more accurate. So the book had remained the same, but our capacity to deal with it had changed. So instead of, I'm quoting now, it's a wonder I haven't abandoned all my ideals. They seem so absurd and impossible. Yet I keep clinging to them because I still believe, in spite of everything, that people are truly good at heart. However, there's another reference which I find equally powerful, where she says, Anne Frank in her diary, there's a destructive urge in people, the urge to rage, murder, and kill, and until all humanity, without exception, undergoes a metamorphosis, wars will continue to be waged. So my point is that this material is all in the diary, in this incredibly intelligent, incredibly wise 13 to 15 year old, but only what we can hear in the diary changes over time. And I call it a living book because it's a heartbreak. If you read it as I feel it should be read, it's a story written by a young woman, a young child rather, she's an adolescent, who is saying, I want to write a mystery, and you won't know how it ends until it ends. She doesn't know how her story will end until it ends, but we do as we're reading it. It's astonishing.
Yes, exactly. One reads it with such a sense of poignancy and sadness.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And what a shame that this remarkable imagination was terminated out of racial hatred.
Right. You know, as you pointed out before, that a higher proportion of Dutch Jews were killed than anywhere else in Western Europe. And there were several reasons for this. But one of the most interesting that you indicate also in the book, in the betrayal of Anne Frank, is the I don't know if you go into detail about it, but from my own research, I know it was due to the inspector of population registries, Jacob Lentz. There was a highly efficient and comprehensive population registry that he devised actually on IBM punch cards, which made it. And then there was a rule that everybody in the Netherlands, this is in the 1930s that he devised it, everybody in the Netherlands had to register, and their religion was put down on these punch cards. Which just really brings up the whole notion again, Hannah Arendt's notion of the banality of evil. I mean, after the war, he claimed he was just being a civil servant. Talk about what you discovered, Rosemary Sullivan, what you discovered in about the different motivations that people had to justify their actions of collaboration with the Nazi occupiers.
Wow, that is a very large question. Let me start with this notion of the similarity in temperament, in the attitude towards order that the Germans and the Dutch share. This idea that you would have a brilliant, so-called, system to register everyone, and that their religion would be registered, and the explanation of their religion being registered seems to have been that there was public funding for religions, and so you had to have some system to enumerate what went where, etc. It was all bureaucratically accurate, but the bureaucracy became under the Nazis a bureaucracy of evil. People after the war justifying themselves. When I went to the Resistance Museum in Amsterdam, I was intrigued by a particular exhibition, which was the wall of the of a parade of Nazi collaborators of Dutch who had become NSB, and their explanations for why they decided to become are kind of strangely contemporary. One of them, for instance, what attracted me to the NSB was the energy, the singing, and the sense of belonging.
The NSB being
the Nazi, the Dutch Nazi Party, the anti-Semitic Dutch Nazi Party, NSB. So what attracted me to become a member of the NSB was the energy, the singing, and the sense of belonging. These are all balloons out of the mouths of these figures who have been photographed and put on a huge wall display. I saw only one choice, National Socialism or the choice of communism. We couldn't make a living from the shop, and the NSB claimed things would get better for the middle class. With Germany in power, membership of the NSB offered opportunities for starting a career. There was enormous poverty and division in our country. The NSB was opposed to such a pretense of democracy. Leadership was something we could build a national community on. With too many choices, nothing gets done, and there's always this self-interest that's hiding around the corner. I mean, you know, it sounds like the reasons why people get attached to Donald Trump. In the early days, again, for me, one of the most moving parts of writing this book was my encounter with Otto Frank. The stature, the heroic stature of the man. But I remember encountering how in 1933, when Hitler was named chancellor, he was with his wife at a dinner party with friends. And the announcement came over the radio, and the friend said, well, let's see what the man can do. I mean, that's actually very familiar, right? So how do people justify themselves after the war? I love a quotation from Solzhenitsyn, which is that there's always evil in the world. And so there's a tolerance for evil. But once that level of tolerance is surpassed, all hell breaks loose. The way in which it's happening in the Ukraine right now, what happened as, it started out as diplomatic disputes and this and that, and then the lies build, and then there's the explosion into this level of violence and degradation that is just shocking, that human beings are still capable of that.
Right, the breakdown of all norms of behavior.
Yeah.
And of course, as you point out, the marriage of the breakdown of all norms of behavior with this bureaucratic efficiency.
I know. And apart from that, there are other explanations that account for the large number of or percentage of the population who was deported, which include everything from this, what they call the silo system of or social organization in the Netherlands, where, you know, you had your Catholics who had their universities and their churches and their schools, and then the Protestants and the liberals and so on. Also the fact that it was Citizen Card, an Austrian who was a layman, as it were, head of the government of the Nazis, and not the Wehrmacht or the Navy or whatever as in other countries, which made a difference. He was able to act on his anti-Semitism with no constraint whatsoever. So there were other reasons for the deportation, but what is interesting is that it's estimated, and again, can only be estimated, that something like between 25 and 27,000 people, Jewish people, managed to go into hiding, but one third of them were betrayed.
Yes, and so now let's get back to that betrayal. The cold case team in this book, The Betrayal of Anne Frank, zeroed in on ultimately, I mean, there were something like 30 suspects, but they zeroed in on 4 potential suspects. What were the criteria that enabled them to hone down their list to these 4?
Well, you know, again, to step back just a smidgen from that question, Vince, with his FBI training, set up a certain number of projects. One he called the Residence Project, which was to determine who lived where in proximity to the Anne Frank house. Which betrayers, which informants, which NSB members lived in adjacent buildings. The Statement Project, so that everybody who ever spoke about the Anne Frank story, particularly, of course, the helpers like Meep Geese and Bep Voskeil, those statements were all collected and collated. There was the arrest tracking process, where they tracked arrests from 1943 to 1944 to see if they could find a pattern. There was mapping projects. You know, they found out that there was an SD informant at the bicycle shop around the corner from the annex. There was a waiter at the local cafe who was an informant. So that was his strategy. Now, the next thing that Vince did was direct the team to identify suspects. And the things that had to conform for a suspect to continue to be under suspicion were 3 things: whether the suspect had knowledge of the Jews in hiding in the annex, whether he or she had motive, and then finally, whether they had the opportunity. So for me, the structuring of the book, once I began to go into depth into the cold case investigation, was to go from one suspect to the other. And, I was helped by the team. Vince, for instance, said, why don't you begin with the first betrayer, who was a man called Job Jensen, who worked for Otto Frank and actually reported him seriously to the Dutch NSB, who would have sent him off to the SD, the German intelligence, for making negative comments about the Germans' capacity to win the war. So, you know, you go from case to case to case. And then finally, there were four, as you say, suspects who had to be looked at carefully. One of them was a woman called Nellie Voskile. And Nellie was the sister of one of the helpers, Bette Voskile. She was fraternizing with a German. She had an Austrian boyfriend. But more seriously, she actually moved to France and worked on a German air base. So, I mean, that's fairly serious collaboration. She would have known the flights of planes carrying weapons and so on. And so the Instant Company looked very carefully at Nellie. They looked at Van Maren, the warehouse man, and so on. But in the end, what determined the focus on the person that was selected by the team as the most likely suspect was a discovery that had been made before. There had been references in Carol Ann Lee's biography of Otto Frank and in some of the NIAID material of an anonymous note that was delivered to Otto Frank after he returned from Auschwitz in the summer of 1945. And the anonymous note said, your hiding place was betrayed to the Office for Jewish Immigration by Arnold Vandenberg, who lived at such and such an address, and other lists were also given.
Well, this anonymous note, it was actually dismissed as evidence before, even though it actually named somebody. And even Vince Pankoke, you say in the book, he was reading it for the 100th time when he noticed something different. And by the way, I think that's a very telling thing. I mean, when you do research like this, you have to read things for hundreds of times often to really, you know, find something new. What did he notice that was so different, even though he had been looking at this piece of paper so many times?
He noticed that it was your hiding place, the address. What Vandenberg had obviously given over to the German intelligence was a list of addresses of Jews in hiding, not names, which made a huge difference. Now, this note in the investigation of 1963, Detective Van Helden was told by Otto Frank about the note, was told that the note was waiting for him when he returned from Auschwitz, but he didn't say exact date when he got it, but it was waiting for him. And he gave Van Helden, the Dutch detective, a copy of the note. Did Otto take this note seriously? It was the conclusion of the cold case team that he did. One of the things he did was he went to the jail where two of the arresting Dutch officers who worked for the 4B4, as it was called, Jew hunting unit, were incarcerated and asked about Vandenberg. He didn't receive any real information, but it suggests he was curious. He kept the note, obviously. In the 1948 investigation, all the focus was on the warehouse man, Van Maren. And it seemed that the people who helped to hide the aide in the attic, that's Meep and Bepp and Victor Kugler and Kleinman, they were pretty convinced that it was he who had done it. Otto went along with it. He wasn't even interviewed because he was incarcerated. He never met the warehouseman. But by 1963, his attitude seemed to have changed. It was that change of attitude that the group examined so carefully to reach their conclusion that it very likely could have been Arnold Vandenberg who was the betrayer.
So tell us about Van den Berg. He was in the Yotzerad, the Jewish Council. You go into the history of the Jewish Council. Tell us about that and his position within it. And then I'm going to ask you, you know, more about like his motivations.
Van den Berg was a notary. And as you know, a notary in the Netherlands is quite a much more sophisticated a position than when we speak of notaries in North America. He was one of a half dozen of Jewish notaries in the Netherlands. He, before the war, had been on a committee to assist refugees fleeing from Germany. We were able to interview his granddaughter. And it was a portrait of a very compelling man. He loved 17th and 18th century art and collected it. He moved in very powerful circles. One of his associates was a man called Meidel, who was a German who had become a naturalized Dutchman, and he was a banker. And together, Van den Berg and Meidel would go to auctions to collect great art. The granddaughter was saying that walking into the house was like walking into the Rijksmuseum or something. In any case, when the Germans invaded, one of the first things that happened was Goering in particular was greedy to collect, that is confiscate, at ridiculously low prices, Dutch art. There was a collection called the Goudstikker Collection, and that was one of the most famous collections of 17th and 18th century paintings. Meidel became the so-called purchaser. Van den Berg was the notary, and the real buyer behind the scene was Goering. The collection sold for an incredibly inadequate amount. Goudstikker was able to get himself and his wife out of the country, but his mother refused to leave. And so he asked Meidel to protect his mother, which he did. And it was eventually Van den Berg who provided his house for the mother, who was, by the end of the war, she had no J on her identity papers because she had been completely Aryanized by Meidel. He had that level of power. Van den Berg worked on the Jewish Council. To me, what was impressive was that Vince and Peter were able to contact a woman who had worked as a secretary for the Jewish Council, Mirjam Bol, and she was in her late 90s. Living in Israel, but very compos mentis. And she remembered that Van den Berg was on the council. She didn't have a sense of him, but she did say that it was a shock to her to see how the Jewish Council, which had been put in place by the Nazis as a kind of conduit for those measures, such as wearing J on your clothing, those measures they were imposing on the Jewish population to keep this as something between the Nazis and the Jews, which the general public wouldn't know about as much. So,
And let's just restate that the Jewish Council was the mediator between the anti-Jewish measures of the Nazis and their enforcement in the Jewish population so that people who were not Jewish would not really get to witness, although they certainly did witness once the razzia started, once the raid started, but that people wouldn't see what was going on.
I think that's absolutely accurate. And further, one should add to that it made sense. There was a big debate in the Jewish community. There was an organization that established itself right at the time of the war that said, we will not deal in any way with the Nazis. Then the Jewish Council said, we must deal with them because maybe we can mitigate their measures. And in fact, often that's what happened. The Germans would offer, you know, we want one half of your population to be deported by such and such a date, and they might be able to get it down a few. But Boal, in her in a book she published of letters to her fiancé, speaks of how she feels that the JC is being used as a butcher's job once again, when they are told that they should pick people to get spears or special stamps, which would delay their deportation. By the end of the war, it is David Cohen, who's one of the chairman, co-chair of the Jewish Council, who said poignantly he'd misjudged the unprecedented murderous intentions of the Nazis. They thought that, you know, being the Netherlands, it wasn't Poland, it wasn't, you know, the Ukraine, being the Netherlands, the Nazis would never do what they had done elsewhere, which was try to create a society that was so-called Jew-free.
Well, there were certainly areas of the Netherlands that were declared Judenfrei throughout the war. But you're right. I mean, they didn't take people and march them through the streets and gun them down openly. That would not have gone over too well.
But also, it should be added, to be fair, that the first protest against the Nazi occupation and the first collection of young people to be deported, young Jewish men to be deported, was the occasion for a large protest by something like 300,000 people, non-Jewish people protesting, railway workers and others. Reprisals on the part of the Nazis were so violent that it, according to even the resistance, it prevented a kind of organized response to the Nazis until about 1943, by which time they had been very efficient in eliminating a huge part of the Jewish population. So it's too late.
And we should just mention, too, that actually the first resistance began in the southeastern part, the Catholic part of Holland, and it was specifically organized to find hiding places for Jews. And just a little plug for my family, my father was one of those people who brought Jews from Amsterdam to the southeast. It was his hometown region. But yes, it took a long time, and a lot of the people, those young people who were those strikers in February of 1942, were sent to Mauthausen, which is one of the most brutal, lethal concentration camps in the Nazi system. But let's talk about Otto Frank. Why do you think he basically hid the name? I mean, you say that the story of the betrayer is less a mystery unsolved than a secret well kept. Why did Otto Frank keep secret the identity of Arnold Vandenberg, who he, you know, was pretty sure, and Miep, he says, well, she participated in this. I mean, she once let fly, as you say in the book, Rosemary Sullivan, in The Betrayal of Anne Frank, that she knew the betrayer, but then she kind of covered up her traces. Why would they not report this?
Well, this was a very important element of the investigation. When Vince talks about the statements project, it was a matter of collecting all statements by all who had in any way been associated with the annex. And it was discovered that a Catholic priest, Father John Nyman, described how Miep Gies in 1996, when her book, Anne Frank Remembered, which had been turned into a documentary, was given an Academy Award. At a party, she said to him, quite out of the blue, that Otto knew who had betrayed Anne Frank, and that she knew, but she didn't say who. Later, in a public context, when she's asked by a member of the audience what happened about the betrayer, she said, well, by the time of the 63 investigation, he was dead. He died before 1960. When asked by others what Otto's motive for knowing the betrayer but not speaking, her explanation was that he wanted to protect the man's family. Well, there's a whole bunch of characteristics of the betrayer that are thereby identified. But for me, one of the most curious incidents is that there's a point in the book where I turn to Wiesenthal.
Tell our listeners who he was.
Simon Wiesenthal, as you know, was the most efficient and powerful of the Nazi hunters, holding the Nazis responsible in the post-war context. He was involved in the pursuit of Eichmann and the trial in the 1960s and so on. So he was at home when he received a phone call from a friend, and a friend said, they're putting on a play of Anne Frank, and there's young people in the rafters who are throwing down pamphlets saying Anne Frank is a fraud, she didn't exist, she's in the diary's an invention of the Jews trying to get more reparation out of the Germans, etc. Shocking. So, and the next evening, Wiesenthal is with his friend in a cafe, and they call over one of the young people, and Wiesenthal says to him, you know, you don't think Anne Frank existed? Well, where is she? And he said, she's buried in a mass grave in Bergen-Belsen. But the kid then says, prove it. And Wiesenthal says, well, if I were able to find the man who arrested the people in the annex on August 4th, 1944, would you believe it? That Anne Frank existed, and therefore the Holocaust existed. And the young man said, well, if he said he did, yes, I would believe it. So by 1957, Wiesenthal had set out to find Silberbauer, the SD officer who had led the raid, and didn't until 1963 actually uncover and locate him. And one of the reasons is that Otto Frank had told Miep Gies that when asked what the name of the officer was, she should say Silver Thaler or Silver Naylor. She should not give the right name. Now, why would Otto Frank want to mislead Wiesenthal, whose motive was to prove in an era when Germany was beginning to deny their responsibility for the Holocaust? Why would he interfere with Wiesenthal? And the only reasonable explanation is that he was worried that Silberbauer might be able to give the name of the betrayer. So we have a bunch of criteria. The betrayer seems to be male, dead before 1960, has a family to protect, and some of the suspects, such as Hans van Dijk or Nelly Voskuyl, they don't fit that profile. Van Maaren was also alive. So who fits that profile? Vandenberg died in 1950 of throat cancer.
Do you think that part of it was the fact that Arnold Vandenberg was Jewish and a prominent member of the Jewish community? Do you think that weighed in?
I don't think prominence is the issue, but I think certainly that he was Jewish. But, you know, as an outsider who has read a great deal and has the most profound sympathy, I'm an outsider. But all my friends whose parents, for instance, were DP, one of my dear friends, her mother, had been rounded up by the Nazis in Poland, and they were in a school field and were told to run, and then they were all shot down. One of these Polish young men who was doing the shooting came along and found her, realized she was alive, and said she's dead because he knew her and she'd been a friend. And that's how her mother survived. I mean, these stories are just unbelievable. Otto Frank, to me, when he spoke about marrying Fritzi, whom he'd met on the platform of a train in transit back to the Netherlands, and married 8 years later, He said that the only reason he and she could be together was that she had lost her husband and her son. He had lost his wife and his daughters. And so they could understand the loss that each buried within them. I think that the story of Vandenberg was over. That door could be closed. What was the use of identifying him when the only ones left to face the implications would be his children, and that could be used, yes, by anti-Semites to say, you know, that the Jews were responsible for their own suffering or some such nonsense. But the point is that I feel that Vandenberg was as much a victim as anybody in this. He had an ordinary life, a good life. And it was the Nazi German invasion of his country, occupation, that turned his life into a world where untruth was weaponized, fascism was mainstreamed, and fear dictated how people related to each other. You learn not to speak, to live in different compartments of yourself. Vandenberg did everything he could legally to protect his family. He bought the 120,000 spear, which was the most expensive and most powerful, a stamp that you could have on your identity papers, delaying your deportation to Auschwitz, though of course it only delayed it by a few months. He was able to get himself a Kalemeyer status, which was you could ask for an assessment of your genealogy to prove that you only had one Jewish parent. I mean, what kind of crap is that? And then he maintained relationships with somebody like Meidel. When his daughter was being helped by the Dutch resistance to go into hiding, she was stranded on a train platform and arrested by the local Nazis because apparently somebody looked at her and said she was Jewish. She was in a jail cell for days, and her father had always said, if you ever get into a terrible corner, speak of Meidel, which she did, and obviously they allowed her to continue to go into hiding. So he did everything he could. It was when Meidel himself gave up and decided to take his paintings and go to Spain as he watched the Germans losing the war, that the protection that Vandenberg had was gone. And it may have been at this time that he, who knows when he got this list of addresses, he turned the list of addresses over. Now, again, I'm sure in his heart, he told himself, well, maybe many of these people have already moved on. But who can judge a man who knows that his children, his wife, himself, will be sent to a camp where they will be exterminated? What you wouldn't do to protect those you love?
I guess on that note, I'd like to ask you then finally, I'm sure there were many lessons you learned from this book, and we've talked about the relevance of the book to what we face today. What's your biggest takeaway from this cold case investigation and your investigation, your writing of this book?
I suppose it goes back to Anne Frank's comment in her diary. How is it possible that in the 21st century, you know, 78 years after the arrest of the people in the annex, we are still in the zeitgeist of murderousness, that people will continue to murder each other, to turn on each other, to be trapped within nationalist ideologies with ambitions for imperial dominance that leads to the death of hundreds. You know, you watch the pictures in the Ukraine, and the only explanation that seems to be the case is that Putin wants to reassert Russian power. He wants to reclaim the territories that were lost with the dissolution of the Soviet Union. And he's willing to, you know, take as many lives as is necessary in order to create this empire as his legacy. You know, when will we get past that? To me, the huge issue that we are facing is environmental degradation. I mean, we've gone from a pandemic, which is also most likely human fueled. It is the cutting down of the wild spaces so that species that would be isolated have begun to move into so-called civilized areas. I believe it was the Wuhan market and infected animals being sold, wild animals, that was the origin of the COVID. We have a number of very, very moving initiatives to create a green world. We have technology fusion that may save us. And yet at the same time, we have this other world of murderousness and bombing that is something out of, the past. That's the biggest lesson I've learned. When can we as human beings change, or will the universe, the planet have to eliminate us so that it can continue on? I've just read a wonderful book called The Mother Tree by Suzanne Simard, in which the cooperative nature of the forest, the underground networks connecting all the trees, is so counter, and it's scientifically proven, counter to the notion we've had of competition between species and so on as being the only modus operandi. We got to somehow change our human. I don't know, mentality.
We need to create the love community, not the hate community.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I could not agree with you more, Rosemary Sullivan. And your book, The Betrayal of Anne Frank, A Cold Case Investigation, is a fascinating story, but one that has such poignant and important relevance to us today. So thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. It's been a pleasure.
Rosemary Sullivan is the author of The Betrayal of Anne Frank. Go to the show page for this episode at writersvoice.net for links to the controversy over its conclusions. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox, or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.